Hey guys, it's Payne. I'm really excited to introduce a brand new show to Bet the Board that combines sports and alternative investing, the very first of its kind. Sports betting and collectibles converging is inevitable. Let me tell you why. Sports cards and memorabilia are another way to get money into the market and do it without limit restrictions or the substantial hold you're accustomed to with sports betting. Whether you collected cards as a kid and are looking to get back into the hobby, this podcast is for you. If you've been collecting cards for years, this podcast will make you think and operate more efficiently. Are you in real estate? The parallels to investing in sports cards and memorabilia are uncanny. You're on Wall Street? Well, listen close. The best sports cards have outperformed the S&P 500 by 6x since 2013. And during the 2008 market crash, sports cards held up better than the S&P 500. Bet the Board, in conjunction with PWCC, presents Cardboard Chat, an entertaining, sophisticated, and informative podcast that combines sports, analytics, betting, cards, and memorabilia. Without further ado, this is Cardboard Chat with Jesse Craig, a leading figure in the collectible space, and me, Payne. So we know we're doing this podcast because there's a clear crossover in sports betting and cards, but you texted me on Sunday asking me about the Houston Texans and why that line was so high against the Dallas Cowboys, and there'd been some people clamoring from the card world that they wanted on our gambling podcast to create a segment called Average Joe's Pick of the Week, where we would debate why that pick was bad or good. It hasn't happened yet. But talk to me about why you like the Houston Texans yesterday.
Well, I mean, first of all, it sounds like a great idea, and I actually think you should implement that at some point. But yeah, look, I've read some things and some articles about NFL games where the spreads are over 10, they're double digit spreads, and you know, there's a lot of data there, and historically, I believe it was in the high 50 percentile of those time that the underdog won the bet. And so with that spread being 17, I looked at it and said, holy crap, like the Cowboys aren't that great in my opinion. And the Texans, while they are terrible, I figured they would get up for that game. And I just looked at it and thought, man, that seems like a fairly high percentage chance to win versus, you know, as the underdog versus, you know, taking the, what, over? They have to win by 18. That's a big spread in a professional NFL game.
It is. So the first positive was Lovie Smith smartly went to Davis Mills again, who is clearly better than Kyle Allen. We have him about 2.5 points better to the spread than Kyle Allen. And then you have, you know, it's kind of that playing big brother approach, right? The Texans versus the Cowboys, and
state rivalry.
These are professionals, and you know, you leak it into the locker room that this is the largest spread of the entire season, and so there's a little bit of a motivational angle there. One interesting point about that game: it opened 17. Professional money came in on the Texans, went down to 16.5, and then a group came in and bet it for the Cowboys, and it got as high as 18 before a more respected group said, hey, this is a little bit too crazy, ultimately closed 17. Now, I knew you had a little degen in you, but I didn't know you were betting games individually. I knew you were part of pools. So the first thing I asked you is, where are you betting these games? And the response was, uh-oh, you're going to ask me to be your mule.
Well, look, I mean, you know, any edge you can get in the gambling space is important. And look, I've got the ability to bet out here in Oregon now via DraftKings, so bring it on, baby.
You got a lot of staff members over there at PWCC.
Into a whole operation. Multiple mules.
Okay, so one thing that we wanted to talk about that to me is very interesting, and you're the expert on this stuff, and I'm sure you deal with collectors all the time, and you hear scarce and rare. There's kind of a misconception now between some of these terms, and people are taking them well out of context. And so we thought we'd reel this thing back in and discuss real scarcity versus perceived scarcity. So I'll let you take it from there and give some viewpoints, and then I'll expound on a couple of things.
Sure. So, you know, this is a big topic in the space. You know, we've had a massive increase in pricing over the last couple of years, which leads things to come out of the woodwork that normally wouldn't, or things to turn over more frequently than they normally would. And so perceived scarcity versus actual scarcity is an interesting topic, but it's also one that's very important for you to navigate the space as a collector or investor. So, you know, chances are if you're buying something that's serial numbered, you know, 25 or less, that's going to be rare. There's 25 that exist, right? That's an easy thing to look at, but you can see items like I'll use the National Treasures Mahomes 2017, his rookie out of 5, the black variation. Okay, there's 5 that exist on the planet, mm-hmm. and this is a monster card. It's a 6-figure card. The crazy thing about this card has sold 7 times in the last 2 years. 7 times for a card out of 5.
Yep.
That is absolutely wild. So the perceived scarcity of this card is much less than the reality that there's only 5 in the world. And it has absolutely affected the price, right? Like this card sold for north of $500,000, and it's all the way down in the 200K range because people have just had it shoved in their face 7 times in the last 2 years. And you know, another example that you can use is the Brady Champ ticket. I think that's almost the most obvious example of perceived scarcity versus real scarcity that exists. Here you have one of the most important cards in our market, Tom Brady's best card. There's 100 that exist. And this card has seen incredible growth since the beginning of 2021. So what happens when you have even the strongest of collectors with cards in their portfolios that love Tom Brady, they love the Patriots, they don't ever want to sell this card. When you see the growth that we saw in some of these staggering numbers where you see, you know, 8-5 selling for over $2 million, 9 selling for over $3 million, sometimes that is life-changing money to these people, and you cannot ignore that. So that ultimately creates a flood of supply to the market. And that's what we've seen the last 2 years with the Brady Champ tickets. We have seen, remember, there's only 100 of these. 35 of them have sold in the last 2 years.
It's unreal.
35. I mean, now, Payne, remember 3 years ago, if a couple sold in a year, it was like, oh, wow, a champ ticket's being sold, right? Like that was it was so exciting because you have all this pent-up demand for an asset. You have all these buyers come out of the woodwork and they fight and they compete over it. But when it's getting traded on a monthly basis or multiple times per month, which is what we're seeing with these champ tickets right now, it creates a lack of scarcity for a card that really is very rare for the most desirable Tom Brady card on the planet. And you could take a card like the 97 PMG Jordan Red, which, you know, those are numbered out of 100, but really there's only 90 that exist because the greens are the first 10. And we've only seen 10 of those sell in the last 2.5 years. Right? So it's a big difference.
It's that set, man. I mean, it is tough prying those away from super collectors. And I was going to take this in a different direction, but I kind of want to follow up now and ask you this, because if I'm just listening to this for the first time and didn't really know anything about it, it would almost come off as a negative that these Tom Brady champ rookie tickets are selling so frequently. Now, all of a sudden, my mind is saying this could be the opportunity to catch
exactly.
one a little bit at the bottom,
100%.
To understand that, you know, once a guy has one or two, he's probably not going to be bidding on the 34th or 35th option, right? And so that right, immediately right. enters my mind.
100%. So when you look at the opportunity that's at stake for a lot of these cards, if you see a card turn over very frequently and you see a pattern. Now, look, it's just like we talk about timing, right? You can't time the top. You can't time the bottom. You can't time when the flood of supply is going to stop. So trying to get that quote unquote deal.
Right.
It's not, there's no perfect science for it. But, you know, these 8-5s, for example, these 8-5 champ tickets, they sold for over $2 million at one point. And now I would say an 8-5 is probably worth $700,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 750,000. But I promise that these cards will go into the hands of prominent collectors and they will not sell them for a long time. You're seeing the turnover and the changing of the guard when it comes to the champ tickets. And I guarantee you that this supply will dry up, and it's not going to be 35 of these selling every 2 years.
I completely agree. I think the other interesting element here, and maybe a different viewpoint of real scarcity versus perceived scarcity, does that come sometimes with grading? I mean, the one card that's, I wouldn't say near and dear to my heart, but is super familiar is a 1993 Upper Deck SP Derek Jeter, where SP was supposed to mean short print, but you could open a box of 93 SP and get multiple Jeters from the same box. And if you look at PSA and SGC, there's over 26,000 graded, but it does come with this perceived scarcity because there's only 25 Gen Mint copies between the two companies. So maybe talk about real versus perceived scarcity within grading and what that does for cards.
Yeah, it definitely does. It creates scarcity for sure. And that is... that is something where our eye appeal comes into play as well, in my opinion, because you can look at, you know, I'll use the Jeter as an example. There's a lot of nines out there that PSA nines that are probably nicer than some PSA 10s.
Yes.
Right.
It's especially just one or two of them.
It's just the truth. And so but those PSA 10s, because of the holder, is creating scarcity and rarity. And, you know, PSA 10s are what, 250,000, 300,000 now. And you've got PSA 9s are $5,000. Are they less?
That's exactly right. Yeah. About 5,500 bucks.
Yeah. So, I mean, that delta is massive. And when you actually broke it down and you looked at the cards individually, I think you can make an argument that, you know, some of the 9s are nicer than some of the 10s. So yes, grading does create scarcity. It does add value. But, you know, the thing I would tell a lot of my clients is, well, what has the highest ROI potential if you're looking at PSA 9s or PSA 10s for that Jeter? Like, do you want to go after the big boy? Do you want to just, you know, be able to say that you have a PSA 10 Jeter? Okay, fine, then go get the PSA 10. But if you actually want to make money, you might want to take a look at buying quantity of the PSA 9s. And I've told guys that in the past, and they've absolutely crushed it on a few examples, one of them being the 1980 Topps Ricky Henderson rookies. I had one client that bought 30 or 40 nines when they were like $300 or $400. And, you know, now they're, I think they're 1500 or something like that. So he like 3 or 4x'd his money on PSA nines instead of going and buying a PSA 10 that has now settled in at probably 2.5x what it was at the time. So his ROI was probably double what it would have been if he would have bought a PSA 10.
Yep.
So it just really depends on what you're looking for.
Very similar to stocks, right? Just being able to buy more shares. I think, you know, as we put a bow tie on this, thinking about something that's super rare and perceiving it to be far more scarce than it actually is, to your point, causes collectors and investors, not just in the sports card space, to kind of increase their risk by paying more for something than they probably should because they believe the scarcity comes with greater expected return, which you just kind of debunked there. And, you know, it's true if the item is actually scarce, but you can get caught holding the bag if you're not accurately identifying some of these assets. And I think the one card that we've constantly talked about and the one set that we've mentioned numerous times is that 1997 Metal Universe PMG set, whether it's the red or the green, even with 90 copies in the red, to your point, just 10 sold in the last 2 years, just kind of tells you what that set means to basketball collectors.
Yep. Internationally, domestically, critically important set. And, you know, those collectors just have a tough time letting it go because they know if they do let it go, you know, this market keeps going up. Chances are they might not be able to afford one again. So instead of capitalizing on the uptick, you know, they don't care about the money. They just want to own the card. So they have it in their collection because they absolutely love it.
Another card that people just seem to want to own is going to lead us into our next segment called It's Time.
Let's go, let's go, let's go. It's time, folks. That's right. We're going to discuss undervalued and overvalued cards, or maybe even some memorabilia assets, potentially some players. Is it time to buy, sell, or hold on to these assets or players? We'll give you some opinions and back it up.
So when you sent over the card that you're going to let our audience know is a little bit overvalued, I had to do a double take, almost fell out of the computer chair. We're looking at the 1952 Topps Mickey Mantle. I can't even say it out loud that it's on this overvalued list. You're going to give us your best Stephen A. Smith hot take impression here. Talk to us a little bit about why you think the 1952 Topps Mickey Mantle is overvalued at this point.
Look, we're due for a hot take in this podcast. So here's my hot take. I think the 1952 Topps Mickey Mantle card is overrated. It's that simple. And let me tell you why. So part of this has to deal with other players from the 50s and the value of their assets compared to the 52 Topps Mantle, right? So that's going to be part of the argument, right? You look at 51 Bowman, you've got Mays rookie, you've got Mantle's rookie, and then, you know, obviously on this, you know, I've said I think that Mays's 52 Topps is underrated, and that's, you know, that kind of ties into this as well. But I mean, look at, and we've talked at the 52 Mays is, you know, in Mantle, the delta is like 8x. I mean, it's insane how big the delta is between the two of them. And if we just want to simplify this and look at those two for why this card potentially could be overrated, ESPN has Mickey Mantle as the number 7 greatest baseball player of all time. They have Mays at number 2. Bleacher Report has Mantle as number 13. They have Mays as number 2. The Baseball Almanac has Mantle as number 17 and Mays as number 2. And going a little deeper, you've got a 20-time All-Star in Mantle, 7-time World Series champion, 3-time AL MVP, Triple Crown winner, one-time Gold Glove, 4-time AL home run leader, and he's 18th on the all-time in home run list. That sounds pretty impressive. Well, let's look at Mays. 24-time All-Star, 2-time NL MVP, World Series champion in 1954, 12-time Gold Glove winner, 4-time NL home run leader, 4-time stolen base leader, and he's 6th all-time in home runs. Now, in my opinion, the arguments to be made for this card, as in the Mantle to be worth more than the Mays, is the fact that it's a high number, right? So the supply is a little less than 2x from what we've seen getting graded. It's not as drastic as everybody really leads it out to be. He played for the Yankees, one of the biggest franchises in the world, which, you know, obviously helps with the Mantle brand and the demand for his assets. And he did win 7 World Series, right? That is something that you can't ignore. Now, as you and I know, Payne, in baseball, World Series don't always relate to valuable cards, right? Like, you look at Mike Trout's cards. They are worth a fortune, and the guy has done nothing. He's only been to 1 playoff series, and he got swept. So, you know, we could look at basketball too, and you say, well, what about for basketball, where they're even more important? Well, then Bill Russell's card should be worth more than everyone else's, and they're not. So I don't like that argument. So when looking at this on the surface, I just believe. Now look, and when you look at this card too, worldwide, when you talk trading cards, there's probably 3 cards that are the most recognizable. Number 1, in my opinion, is the 86 Fleer Jordan. Number 2 is probably the 52 Topps Mickey Mantle. And number 3 would be the, you know, the Honus Wagner, the T206. So I get it. Like, this card has been pumped to all hell from everybody. And I don't mean pumped in a negative way. I mean, it's just been a very prevalent card because of the Yankee brand, because of Mickey Mantle. But I just don't think, in relative to what May's card is worth, I think it's overvalued.
I think you actually hit the nail on the head a few shows back in that Willie Mays across the board is just wildly undervalued, more so than Mickey Mantle is overvalued.
Sure.
But I get your point. And I think you've hit it perfectly on why Mantle sells for more. It's the bigger brand, right? Mm-hmm. He's personally the bigger brand. Mantle did play in the biggest sports city for the largest baseball brand of all time. There's something to be said about being good and in the limelight. And I'll never contest that Mantle is a better player than Mays.
Right.
But Mays did play until he was 42. Mantle's life choices were a little more fast and free, and that's why he retired at 36. Sure. But you mentioned the 7 rings. And I don't think it's necessarily the barometer for pricing in baseball, just because it feels like it is a sport with so much individuality, right? Like, it's a baseball player in the batter's box going up against another one, and like, you either hit it or you don't. And so there's that one-on-one element there. I know you're a West Coast guy, but I think Joe DiMaggio said it best, right? I want to thank the good Lord for making me a Yankee. And it's tough to compete in the baseball landscape with the Yankee brand. And shit, like, I think we've actually seen it to a lesser degree if you were watching it closely. But the moment Giancarlo Stanton was traded from the Marlins to the Yankees, his Topps Chrome Gold rookies were doubling and tripling overnight. And I would bet large sums of money, had Aaron Judge signed with the Giants in the last week, right, his card prices probably would have dipped a little bit. The pinstripes seem to matter.
Quite a bit. Yeah. No, look, I get it. I'm a Red Sox fan, so hot take again.
Truth comes out, boys. Truth comes out.
So, yeah, maybe there's a little bias here as well. But I'm not necessarily arguing that the actual value of these 52 Topps Mantle cards are overpriced.
Trading cards and memorabilia have seen incredible growth as an alternative investment. The company leading the growth? PWCC Marketplace. PWCC Marketplace runs the largest weekly auction of authenticated sports cards, Pokemon cards, comic books, video games, and memorabilia in the world. PWCC Marketplace also has more than 65,000 items listed in their fixed price marketplace that you can make an offer on right now. Head over to pwccmarketplace.com and see why they're the best option for buying and selling trading cards, memorabilia, and all of your collectibles.
I just think that we got to give some love to Mays. It's just, it's killing me. I don't get it. I want to see his stuff worth more. I don't own a single Willie Mays card. I just think it's an absolute crime that his 52 Topps isn't somewhat closer to Mays.
You have to be the leader of change. We need to see you with a Mays card here pretty soon.
Let me see what I can do.
Okay. I am actually going back to the well with an undervalued card, and it kind of fits into the parameters that we've talked about. Vintage, baseball being out of sight, out of mind. This one's really interesting to me. I had the chance to acquire one at a show in St. Louis, of all places. It's either last summer or the summer before. It's the 1910 American Carmel Pirates Honus Wagner, who you just mentioned a few moments ago. If you look at this card, between PSA and SGC combined, only 146 total copies ever graded. We know both companies' backlogs have shrunk or are non-existent at this point, so there's not going to be any of these funny surprises where suddenly like 10% of the population is going to appear and be unearthed here. So when I look at this one, it's the E92 set within American Caramel for 1910. So this was specifically an 11 card set created to honor the 1909 Pittsburgh Pirates for winning the World Series. And I think what's really appealing about this specific card and why I actually made an investment myself is it has the look and the feel of the T206 Honus Wagner, right? The pose is very similar. The design of the card is similar. The T206, anybody that's passionate about sports knows what that card looks like. They've probably seen an article talking about record sale prices over the last 12 to 18 months where an SGC sold for $6.7 million. Then there was a recent private sale for over $7 million. And to me, that's why the 1910 American Caramel Honus Wagner is wildly undervalued. I get that there's only 50 or 60 copies produced of the T206, but the 1910 American Caramel was also short printed. 99.99% of the people that want a Honus Wagner card or have a passion for vintage but can't afford the T206 Wagner, like, this is the little brother card. This is the sibling card. This is the poor version, okay? And when you look at some of the data here and some of the sales prices, right? In 2021, an SGC4 of this card sold for $14,000. A few months later, the T206 and an SGC3 goes for $6.7 million. So the gap is just far too large for the American Caramel not to be undervalued. And I think anytime you have that correlation, right, and the T206 does become available, it's rarely going to not set a new record. And so I think the American Caramel at some level or some percentage has to kind of fall in line there continually as the T206 sets new records. I just think this has a large upside. And once people kind of understand what it is, understand how rare it is, understand of, you know, the qualities that it has to the T206, people are going to start gravitating to that a little bit more. It wouldn't shock me if that's going to be a riser here in the next 12 to 24 months.
Yeah. First of all, this is a fantastic pick. So kudos. I did, you know, before I knew this card was rare, but I didn't realize how rare it actually was until I started doing a deep dive for the segment. And I'm not going to lie, I kind of looked online and saw if any were available to buy. I mean, this feels like, it feels like the T206 Wagner, to the extent that I just can't imagine you buying the card and then going to resell it a few years down the road and losing money on it. Right. Like, 'cause nobody, the tale is that nobody's ever lost money selling a T206 Wagner. Well, I don't know with how scarce this is. I don't know how you could lose money. The demand's always going to be there for this card. And, you know, from an education perspective, as that keeps, you know, getting poured. I mean, this is a guy, I'm a guy that's an expert in the space, and I didn't realize that there were less than 150 copies that were graded by SGC and PSA. I didn't realize it was that rare. So yep. That was a little bit eye-opening to me. And the fact that, you know, doing my math, I kind of estimate that a T206 Wagner is about 150x in price from this card. No, sir, that's how drastic it is. I mean, yep. It's wild. So it's one of those cards that if you see at the auction block, you just step up and you buy it. I wouldn't have said that about this card before we started the show, but I don't know how you could potentially lose money on this card. I mean, don't be stupid, but two guys listen to this and they just go completely crazy and the card goes up to 200 grand overnight. No, but yeah, then SGC 2 sold a month ago for 23,000.
Okay. Wow.
And an SGC 2 Wagner right now, in my opinion, would probably sell for about $4 million. So if that doesn't show you the delta difference between these two cards, but the scarcity is something that you can't ignore. And you're right, it does have the look and feel that a T206 Wagner has to it, just different color, right? It's like the blue versus the kind of orange. But this is just a fantastic card, and this might be my favorite pick you've ever had in Undervalued.
Wow, I like that. I didn't get much feedback before the show, but I appreciate that. Now, all of a sudden, I wish I didn't divulge this because I want to go find another copy now, and it feels like there's going to be an increase in price the next one comes to the auction block.
Pick a number, any number, whatever it may be. We got a number inside, but we want a magic number, all right? This is where we're going to pick a few big cards that enter in an auction over the next couple of days, and we're going to try and guess how much they sell for in advance. Throw out a number. We got one, too.
Okay, this is the segment that everyone seems to love. They clamor for. There's been some battles. Some have gone my way. Some have gone Jesse's way. He's catching up. But the one thing I will say about the three cards you picked this week for Magic Number is at least two of them are my vibe. And the first one we're going to talk about is the 1998 UD Choice StarQuest Gold Kobe Bryant. It's in BGS 8.5 grade. It's numbered out of 100 copies. As a Lakers fan and a Kobe guy, I'm going to let you lead here, talk about this card, why it's important, and throw out a number for us here, Jesse.
So yeah, there's only 100 of these that exist, and this is a card that, I mean, Payne, you can speak to this. You just don't see sell hardly ever. I mean, we talked about scarcity at the top of the show, and there's 100 of these. I can find 4 sales in the history of this card at auction. I mean, that's how rare this card is for people to let go. Now, how many of these are still in packs? You know, how many didn't get pulled? How many are overseas in collections? You know, you can run the gambit, but it's an incredibly rare card. I could have used it for Damn That's a Ghost, but you know, this is just, it's a really cool piece. It's not crazy expensive. It's expensive, but you know, we did sell a BGS 8 about 2 months ago for $10,000, and I think that was, you know, we've seen a few sales recently outside of one a couple of years ago. So they've definitely gone up in value. And I think when we talk about turnover, once you get big record sales, well, this card is kind of one of those where all of a sudden we're seeing a few hit the auction block because guys might've scooped these up back in the day for a few $100. Now they're seen to go for 10 grand and then, oh, time to capitalize. So since I'm kicking this off, I still think, you know, even though a couple have sold lately, I still think the buyer pool for this is massive. I've got this one doing $10,750.
That's good. That's good.
Because you're under, I'm guessing.
No. I think this is really interesting. So
to your point on the scarcity, PSA is graded 8 copies. BGS is graded 14. We're pushing close to 25 years of this product being around, and less than 25% of the print run is in a slab. To your point, there are some basketball collectors that don't like their stuff slabbed. They are typically overseas. But the reason this set started becoming far more respected just in the last 5 to 7 years, aside from it being gold and serial numbered, just super scarce, back to what we talked about at the top, and whether it's basketball or baseball, I think respected collectors know that there isn't close to 100 copies in existence. And if you think about this product, it's UD Choice, formerly Collector's Choice. It was the lowest of low end, extremely cheap product for kids. You could find packs at one point in my local card shop as a kid for 50 cents. And you would just see packs kind of tossed out. Cards were tossed out. No one really knew what some of these meant back then. And they were just real needles in the haystack. But why there isn't close to 100 copies is just a lot of these boxes would get tossed. They would just go for so cheap. I mean, this past summer, we're talking, this is a basketball card, but the equivalent in baseball, which is $19.99 UD Choice. I ordered like 10 boxes, Jesse. Average, shipped $32 a box. So, it's just such a cheap product. You're never going to hit one. It'd be a miracle shot, but that just goes to show you how rare these are.
The real question is, did you rip them?
I did. I ripped them all.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, because they're that cheap. That's exactly why I ripped it. I was like, boy, right. If I just hit one of these, this is, you know. So you mentioned some of the recent sales. A PSA 9 Kobe StarQuest Gold just sold for $14,000 last week. The BGS 8 copy you guys referenced, I believe it was at your shop for $10,000 back in October. You hate to say this, but BGS has started to lose some of its luster a little bit with these cards. I don't know why, but that's kind of what's transpiring here. I am lower than you. I'm actually at 9,400. Kobe's market is down about 25% over the last year. I think that kind of nestles me in right here around this price at 9,400. So that's where I'll go. I think we'll have a nice little gap there. Wouldn't shock me if it fell somewhere in between.
Yeah, same. I do think, though, this card is so inherently rare that the holder and the grading company don't matter as much as they would otherwise on other cards.
Yep, you're spot on. The holder and the grade on this next card is really interesting, and it's going to cause a price uptick here. It's the 1979 Topps Hockey Wayne Gretzky rookie in a PSA 8 near mint, but within that near mint grade, PWCC has assessed this as one of the top 5% of all PSA 8s. And it's extremely well-centered. Registration is fantastic. And with this set, there's some edgeware that's common on both the Tops and to a far greater extent, the OPG version, that are non-existent with this specific copy. Interesting conversation, right, that we've kind of broached before, Jesse, with vintage cards. A PSA 8 isn't the same as a PSA 8 in most instances. You can kind of look at them like snowflakes. You guys sold a PSA 8 copy about a week ago that went for $4,300. We've already exceeded that price on this copy, and there's 6 days left of bidding. Just to kind of further illustrate that point with the S Top 5 designation, I think you really have to treat this almost like a PSA 8.5, and there was a PSA 8.5 that sold about 13 months ago for $9,000. I looked at both copies. This one's actually a little bit nicer. Mm-hmm. It's hockey season, so the sport is front and center. Gretzky's market, shockingly, only down about 5% over the last 12 months. I will kick this one off here, Jesse. I'm going to go with 8,400 on this one. My feeling is you're going to be a little bit lower than me.
Okay. So this is probably the nicest PSA 8 that I've ever seen for this
card.
Yep. It's gorgeous. And why it's, you know, I don't know if we're missing something that we haven't looked at it like with a loop that these graders do, but I'm surprised it's not an 8.5, and I think it had an outside shot at a 9 as well, just to be completely frank. It's a gorgeous copy. It's almost dead centered. There's a little bit of print dots on some of the borders, but outside of that, it's just a gorgeous copy. So from an eye appeal perspective, that's why it earned the top 5%. And I really do love this card. I would rather own this card than the majority of PSA 9s that I see, which go for between $30,000 and $40,000 depending on condition.
Yep.
And like you mentioned, you know, we sold an 8 recently for, you know, mid fours. I'm actually higher than you on this one. I think this one's going to surprise us a little bit because,
okay,
like you mentioned, Gretzky's market isn't down very much when, you know, cards overall are have seen a downtick. I'm at 10,200. I think it's going to surprise us.
Wow. I could see that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that copy, the PSA 8.5 did, I think, 9,000 after BP. So it would not shock me that I could be a little bit low here. The next one is an interesting one. It's the 2017 Topps Diamond Icons Logo Man Mike Trout, one of one. It's in a BGS 9.5 Gem Mint grade. I'm going to let you kick this one off. Talk to us a little bit about this set, the importance of Logo Mans, and as we kind of talked about earlier in the show, Mike Trout, despite not winning a playoff series, no hardware in terms of a championship ring, still kind of pacing the modern market for baseball.
Yeah, I mean, his numbers over the last 10 years have been so ridiculous. And if you take injury out of it, it would have been even more wild. So I think that's part of the reason, you know, they talk about five tool players. I mean, you're looking at one. This is another card. I'm someone that I like to buy 101s. I like to buy great patch cards, game used. This card is game used. So this is a card that I would go after if I could bid. Unfortunately, I can't. So that's one less bidder in the bidder pool. But I would definitely be aggressive on this card. And if you look at NBA Logo Man, I mean, Payne, you know how important that is for our space. You know, even the NFL shields are starting to gain some momentum. And I think that, you know, these MLB logos are kind of third to the party here. So I think there's some opportunity, a little arbitrage play here. The logo men for the NBA are critical. And that is the chase card for any player in the NBA, even for non-rookies. I mean, if you look at a Luka Doncic logo man from 2020 or 2021, non-auto, that thing will still bring six figures, even if it's not game used, which is crazy, right? This card, right?
I think
now,
we saw the Mahomes, right? That we talked about a couple episodes ago. The Shield almost did 30K. That was non game used.
That was not game used, right? And Shields don't bring the value that logo men do in the NBA. And then that's what I was mentioning. Like the MLB logo is even behind the Shields. But I think there's a play there to be made for these. And that's kind of why I picked this card, because I think it's an interesting conversation. But this card's sitting at $2,400 right now. It's got 6 days left. It ends this Sunday. And in my opinion, this card should be worth over 10 grand. It's not going to get there, I don't think. It'd be a miracle if it did. But I've got this card at $4,300.
Man, I thought you were selling this one up and you were going to come in at least 6,600. I really thought that.
I'm trying to be a realist on this one.
Here's the interesting part, because you're going to be a little bit stunned here. I did a bunch of research on this card. Couldn't find it. And it does say game used memorabilia on the front of the card. Mm-hmm. That's right under the logo man. But on the back, it says the relic contained in this card is not from any specific game, event, or season. So it threw me for a little bit of a loop. And once I talked to somebody that said it's likely not game used, I was settling in around your number there. In the process of digging into this a little bit, it started to get bid up, and we're, you know, approaching almost 2,500 as we speak on this card. I think it has the ability, and I hate coming in above you on this one, but I am going to just come in a touch above you. I'm going to be at 4,800 on this. I literally thought the way you sold that card to me, you were coming in well above six. And I was like, this one's going to be cake.
No, and look, when you're looking at these cards too, yes, on the back, it's only baseball that you'll see this, where it will say this relic is not from any game or event. But then on the front, and it's always a Topps product where they do this, it will say game used memorabilia underneath it. Now, I have been told that the front of the card is the letter of the law on these cards.
Interesting. I didn't even know that.
I have been told that. So whether that's true or not, I'm going to have to assume that if they put game used memorabilia on the front of a card right under the damn piece, that it's going to be game used. I think it's a generic statement on the back, but I'm assuming that it is game used. And so,
interesting. Well, to your point, there had been a bunch of Jeters because he had just signed with Topps that I have not bid on because of the back of the card. And I'm looking at the prices they're selling for, and I'm like, who on planet Earth is paying that much for it? I'm probably the idiot here. So I'm going to have to look into this a little bit more.
I did the same thing. I kind of ate my words because I did the same thing on a Griffey. It was a jumbo E-letter patch that I thought was game used. I bought it privately from a guy for very inexpensive. It was like $1,500. It was a 101 sweet card. And I got it in. And then on the back, I read the exact same thing that you're reading on this Trout. So I messaged the guy and I'm like, dude, this thing is not game used. Like, he goes, look at the front of it. And sure enough, right under it on the front, it said, you know, game used memorabilia. And I said, oh, okay, great. So that was kind of part of my education process on these pieces, is that they actually are game used. And so you have to be careful, right? These are all little things that when you're
new to the space.
These are all little things that when you're investing that, you know, you need to look at and make sure that you understand. And there's always learning curves, and sometimes you're gonna buy stuff and you're gonna make a mistake and you can go, shit, I screwed that up.
You just keep pushing.
So rule of thumb is when you're looking at these cards, just make sure you do your research. You're gonna make some mistakes, you're gonna screw up, learn from them and move on.
Love it. And from a Mike Trout 1 of 1 to another ghost.
Damn, that's a ghost. We're going to highlight a card that hasn't sold in more than a year right now, or is serial numbered to less than 100 copies produced. We're going to talk about why this card is significant, maybe in terms of hobbies or language or just the overall rarity of it all, and why it's considered a ghost.
This is a set that we talk about as much as we can. That's how important it is. That's how great the cards are. They look fantastic. Just an absolute fantastic set. The 1997 Metal Universe PMG Green Emmett Smith. It's out of 15 copies. It isn't a PSA 5, but again, with these 97 PMGs and really all PMGs, the grade doesn't matter as much. It's all about securing a copy. This specific one ends Thursday night at PWCCMarketplace.com. Talk to us a little bit about this ghost.
Yeah, so you mentioned there's only, you know, we've talked about the 97 PMGs quite a bit and the football variation of these greens. There's only 15 that exist. And it's just one of those cards that we're going to continue to talk about, because for those that haven't had the pleasure of actually holding one in your hand, there's something about the shimmer that comes off of the green on these things that is just, it's really stunning in person. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It's like the most vibrant green you've ever seen in your life. So this card itself, I mean, you got one of the greatest running backs of all time. The last sale for this card was over a year ago. It was in an 8.5 and it sold for $49,200. Now, remember, this is a PSA 5 and there's only 15 that exist. So this is another card where it's true scarcity and the grade doesn't matter as much. I do believe that this card is going to eventually, in this auction, eclipse $50,000. I think it'll sell for more than the 8.5 did. I just know how important this card is. I know a few big guys that are, you know, going after these sets.
Yep.
And the market was even hotter back when the 8.5 sold that only had one, or it was a pop one none graded higher. And I still think that just a base PSA 5 is going to sell for more than an 8.5 none higher did back just over a year ago. We recently sold a PSA 6 Jerry Rice for $137,000, if that gives you any idea of, you know, the value that these things can bring. So, you know, we're likely not going to reach Jerry values, but
no,
I do think it's going to sell for more than the 8.5 did.
There's so much to unpack here. And I think, again, it's perfect, the card that you picked in terms of matching the segment vibe, because this is true scarcity. And even though you alluded to the market being down, when guys want to stay in the space that they believe in, they just start repositioning themselves within the market. And even though, again, the market's down, these cards have not shown to be down. A lot of these rubies, PMGs, you name it, they're actually increasing while the market's down. It tells you how great that asset is. Specific to this, right? I mean, it's a PMG green. It's Emmett Smith. It's America's team. The Cowboys have a massive brand, something we talk about all the time. And I think we can debate until we're blue in the face. Barry Sanders was probably the better back, maybe the best running back ever. Who knows how many yards Sanders would have amassed behind that elite Cowboys offensive line. But past the point of this being a rare PMG green, think about the way the NFL is trending, right? It's a pass-first league. You can count the number of three-down running backs in the NFL on one hand right now. And it's very much committee-based. And because of those two things, it's hard to fathom Emmitt Smith losing his all-time rushing record. And true. I think that has to play a role in this a little bit. But you're going to get multiple collectors from different sectors here. You're going to get the Cowboys super collector. You're going to get the Emmitt Smith super collector. You're going to get a guy who's attempting to complete this set, as you mentioned. And you have two or three guys battling it out. That's the perfect recipe for creating a brand new comp and resetting the entire market.
Yeah, it's such an important card, and it's, you know, very elusive. It's only sold a few times in its history. I think three times, actually, to be exact. And so people know if they don't bid on this card, if they don't go after it, they may not see one for 5 years, 10 years, right? Yeah. Like when is the next one going to pop up? How many of the 15 that exist have actually, you know, made it to the grading companies? That's one thing I didn't research going into this, but I can only imagine it's five or six have been graded. I can't imagine it's much more than that. Usually it's half of the supply or less has been graded.
The thought process behind cards like this is go get it when you have a chance. And so ultimately why these all-time prices get set is it only takes one or two guys saying to themselves, within reason, what is the most I'm willing to bid on this card? And when two guys throw that bid price in, it ultimately sets record, which I think we'll have here.
So we doing this or are we doing that? You tell me and we'll tell you. We're going to compare two cards right now with similar value that are completely different. Let me give you an example. Let's just say for argument's sake, you have a vintage Mickey Mantle baseball card worth $30,000. But you also have a modern-day Joe Burrow rookie card worth $30,000. Which one would you rather have, and why? You tell us, we're going to tell you right now.
One of the better segments that I think are on this show, it's a little underrated, but I love breaking down two cards that are complete opposites and figuring out which one we like just a little bit better. It's tough when you're talking about some of the megastars that you've picked out for us this week. We're looking at a 2001 SPX Albert Pujols rookie auto, serial number to 1,500 copies. It's got an on-card autograph. It's in pristine BGS 10 condition. And the alternative here, a 1998 Fleer electrifying Michael Jordan PSA 10 insert that is just breathtaking. Talk to us about these two cards, Jesse, and then let us know which one you'd rather have.
Yeah, so I picked these this week because I thought it would be difficult on you. I mean, that was the genesis behind it. Last week was going to be tough on me. This week I thought it would be
tough.
Oh, joy.
I appreciate you making things tough on me.
So, you know, looking at the Pujols, for example, this copy in a BGS 10 sold for $3,840 about a week ago. There are 149 PSA 10s. The card's numbered out of 1,500, and there's only 15 BGS 10s. And PSA 10s have actually been selling for about $6,000, but one hasn't sold in the past few months. So I'm curious if one hit the open auction block, what it would bring right now. And rule of thumb is that BGS 10s are, you know, call it one and a half to double a PSA 10, depending on the card. But, you know, this one selling for $3,840 is kind of interesting and making me look at this this card pretty closely. So that's going to factor into my decision. But the second card is a 98 Fleer electrifying Jordan PSA 10. Again, last week this card sold for $4,200. So a little bit more than the Pujols, but it's an iconic card from the 90s. It's just, like you mentioned, you say breathtaking. It really is. It's got gold to it. You know, it looks like the electrifying card that it is. There's been about 318 of these graded by PSA. There's 70 PSA 10. So definitely more supply for the grade on the electrifying than the Pujols. But still, for a beautiful 90s insert, it's a pretty low supply being only 70. So if I have to choose between the two, based on supply and the fact that I think there might be a little bit of a ROI potential more with the Pujols than the electrifying, I'm going to go with the Pujols, which my guess is that's where you're headed, but let's hear it.
I'm surprised. So I think the perfect depiction of the Jordan card is electrifying, right? It's just the perfect depiction of how that card looks. It is an absolute stunner. It's a classic, right? Every kid remembers that card. We wanted one. We had to own it. It's just so aesthetically pleasing. And just depending on the right amount of light, which angle it's at, it is beautiful. But to your point, it's not overly rare. It comes from the Fleer Tradition set in 1998. It's a little bit of a lower end product. There were 10 players in this electrifying set. The pack odds were 1 in 72. So theoretically, you take about 720 packs to land the Jordan. Mm-hmm. These are condition sensitive, and you alluded to only 70 copies being deemed worthy of PSA 10 status. But I actually own the Albert Pujols card, so I have to go with that one. It's, to me, action shot, on-card auto, serial numbered. It's condition sensitive with some dark blue borders. The other thing that's very important with these cards is some of the autos have some bubbling within them based upon the Sharpie he used. So that can cause a little bit of an uptick, a little bit of a premium if you get one without bubbling. They're actually more prevalent with bubbling than without. So those do cause a little bit of an uptick. But you just talk about Pujols' brand. It's not anywhere near Michael Jordan, so I think it will shock some people that we're both gravitating towards this specific card, but he's reached the milestones that only one other man has. 3,000 hits, 700 home runs. There's only 15 pristine copies. And there's a little bit of an intrigue to this because I know a lot of people will listen to these cards that we're breaking down and then try to go buy some boxes. I know you've done that in the past. So to save you some money, this card wasn't actually in 2001 SPX. So it was released in 2001 Upper Deck Rookie Update. So those are the boxes you would want to gravitate towards if you're attempting to pull one of these Pujols rookie autos. When you look at the spectrum of the autographs for Pujols' rookie year, certainly the Bowman Chrome Refractor to 500 copies is one that we've talked about in this podcast. That would be the pinnacle. But this certainly slots in, I would say, of the normal base rookies that aren't just, you know, true scarce that you just can't find or get your hands on or that only super collectors would know. This would probably, in my mind, be one of his top five rookie auto cards that are prevalent. And so I think for that reason, the long-term upside is there as opposed to a 90s insert that, while looks beautiful, isn't one that a lot of the iconic 90s collectors are going out and getting, right? They're more focused on the Rubies, the PMGs, things of that nature. And this isn't one that typically finds itself on their radar.
Yeah, well, that leads into me taking the ROI play on the Pujols, right? From a for my love of each card, I would easily select the electrifying over the Pujols. But when I'm talking pure ROI, well, I see more upside on the Pujols. So that's why I went that route.
Ditto. I completely agree. The Jordan is much better looking. There's no doubt really about that. Oh, it's not even close. All right, buddy. We're wrapping up episode 8 of Cardboard Chat. Anything you'd like to tell our loyal listeners on the way out?
Just check out the Premier Auction that closes this Thursday. It's a little bit, it's December, so people don't sell quite as much this month. We've got a little bit lighter Premier Auction, 260 cards or so, but there's some really good stuff in there. So I would get in there. I'd take a look at it. Even if you're not going to buy, you can watch the auction close. You know, extended bidding can be exciting with all these bids flying in. So get in there and check it out. And then, hey, we're here if anybody needs anything.
Link to PWCC's website is atop the description. Love chatting with you, Jesse. Episode 9 back next Tuesday.
Make sure you follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. Subscribe to Bet the Board and get notified when new episodes of Cardboard Chat air on Tuesdays. And be sure to stop by PWCCMarketplace.com for all your collecting needs.